Welcome to Hummingbird, a weekly conversation about identity, Celtic and Métis, healing and wellness, the spirit of place, and the pull of mystery. We linger in conversation about things at the center of our creative work and life.
We respectfully acknowledge that this podcast is recorded on the treaty and traditional territories of many nations, including the Anishinaabeg, the Mississaugeag Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, the Mississaugas of the Credit, and the Wendat peoples.
These lands are now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples, and are covered by Treaty 13 with the Mississaugas of the Credit and the Williams Treaty, treaties to peaceably share and protect this land through friendship and respect. We thank those who have cared for this land, and we are grateful for the opportunity to live here and connect through conversation.
So last time we started talking about poems that find us, and I shared with you one that had found me that was typed in an old-fashioned typewriter, which we would consider old-fashioned today, and stuck in between some records in my parents' record collection. And it was Desiderata by Max Ehrman, and it really had a huge impact on my life. And my gosh, reading it with you last week, I hadn't read it in maybe more than a decade or two. I don't know when the last time I read it was, but I've got to tell you, it felt like the words were coming out of my mouth, but I wasn't saying them. I think it was just that familiar. I had read it that many times that it was a really unique reading experience for me.
Well, Jessica, thank you. Thank you for sharing the poem and the beautiful story and how that poem or prose poem found you. And interesting that it was through music, through the record album and the way that it sort of fell out. And in that way that you described reading it and what that was like, it seems to me it was like, and we talked about this in the last episode too, a bit like a homecoming and you coming back to you. So it's a past you meeting the now you into the you of the poem or the prose poem. So that's the gift that poems and prose poems or whatever the text is can give us when we revisit them.
Yeah. And you know, if you were looking at me right now, you'd see my eyes are a little damp.
Aww.
I feel like that's what 2023 is for me. It feels like this is going to be a year of coming home and reclaiming. And so what a beautiful way to have something like this find its way back to me this early on in the year. It's amazing how when you lean in to this experience of going with the flow through conversation as improvisation in a podcast, nothing's scripted, nothing's planned. We just show up to be with each other. And when you do that, then sometimes there's another force, a mystery, a spirit that can take over and can lead you right to where you need to be.
I agree, Jessica. And in thinking about the spirit and the mystery, it makes me also think of intuition and how there's that part of all of us who we have this faculty of that inner knowing and that sixth sense or whatever that is, that gut feeling, whatever you want to call it, and the way that there are often not a lot of ways for that to muscle. And so I really feel that the creative journey, conversations like this, reading poetry, engaging with art, with nature, are ways to tap into that part of ourselves. And I think the more that we do that, the more that it speaks to us as we're experiencing that and have from the beginning, from our first podcast. I think that intuition and mystery and the third party in the Hummingbird podcast, the invisible party, has been accompanying us in every episode and shows up in different ways. And
I like to think of it as the hummingbirds.
Yes.
that are here flying in and amongst us and between us and connecting all of us.
Well, and speaking of which, I get these sort of things through my computer that aren't necessarily something I want to pop up, but something in one of my Microsoft functions does that, and so it will take me to landscapes, and which isn't such a bad thing, but sometimes when I just want to get directly to work, I have to go to this, then get to my document. But the other day, it actually gave me a quiz, and it said,
did you do the quiz?
I was too stunned by the quiz because
oh my god, you follow instructions so beautifully.
the question was, what ingredient goes into the hummingbird cake? And it had like
hummingbird cake.
Yes, and it had like what? A, milk, B, cream, C. I think I'm getting the ingredients wrong, but it was like
really
A, B,
hope
C.
They didn't say hummingbird.
It was a multiple choice question, and I thought, wait a minute here, I didn't even know there was a hummingbird cake. So I got to Google that, and I think we have to bake one, Jessica, at some point together.
Oh my God. Okay. So I just Googled it because I couldn't help myself. Yes. And it says that this is Wikipedia, that it is a banana pineapple spice cake. It looks a bit like a carrot cake to me, originating in Jamaica and a popular dessert in the southern United States since the 70s. And yes, there's flour, sugar, salt, vegetable oil, ripe banana, pineapple, cinnamon, pecans, vanilla extract, eggs, and a leavening agent of some sort.
Wow.
Because I don't know baking. That's probably some sort of thing like baking soda or baking powder. I don't know. The bakers of the world can laugh at me by my lack of knowledge right now. But it looks like a delicious cake with like a cream cheese icing on it in the picture.
I'm sold if there's cream cheese icing. I'm there.
Now, here's another thing that popped up. But people also ask, what does a hummingbird cake taste like? And it says it tastes like a tropical cross between banana bread and pineapple upside down cake with a texture reminiscent of carrot cake with bursts of pineapple and pecans, but no carrots.
Wow, my mouth is watering.
Yeah, I don't know if I can talk today. I don't know.
I know. Okay, listeners, this is going to be a short one. We're
we're going to have to go and learn how to bake next.
I know. Well, and I wonder why it's hummingbird cake.
Right. Why is it called a hummingbird? Okay, here, why do they call it a hummingbird cake? So some say the cake was named after the bird because it was sweet enough to attract hummingbirds who only eat nectar, while others say the yellow streaks of banana was reminiscent of the bird's plumage.
But isn't that interesting that the mystery is also why it's called that? Because it could be this or it could be that, or there's not quite sure. Almost like sometimes something is just named something and then we bring the story second to the name, if that makes sense.
And that's according to Jamie Oliver, you know, and he knows some things.
Oh, he does. That, I mean, I don't bake, but I know Jamie Oliver. I know that name. Yeah, and I also love the concept of leavening agent because I feel that it's so poetic. I feel like there's leavening agents in poetry to make it really work, and that's like the secret ingredient. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Isn't it great fun to take words that are specific to a certain type of activity, like leavening agent, and then to think about it through the work that you do through poetry? So I'm really curious to see if this takes you anywhere. And a hummingbird, could a hummingbird be a leavening agent?
Oh, yes. Well, it is our leavening agent. It's our leavening agent, isn't it?
I feel like, you know, we're completely off track, you know.
I know, but that's what happens.
It is.
And now I can't help but go from leavening agent to lifting agent. I mean, that's the hummingbird. It lifts us. So, all right. Okay.
Well, I'm going to be the focusing agent.
Thank you. As opposed to the secret agent, right?
Oh my gosh. You know, I don't know that I would be a very good secret agent because I like to share all the things with all the people.
Good to know.
So don't be looking to me to be the secret agent.
And thank you, Jessica, for bringing us back here to the landing agent, the landing. But going back to poems finding us and how you shared yours last episode. And yeah, I've been thinking about that too. And I'm going to share this poem now. And it's a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. And it's a poem that our listeners may know titled One Art. And I remember when I first started entering into the poetry world, and I've spoken about this in previous episodes too, because I don't think I would be a poet otherwise, but it was through the loss of both of my parents that poetry found me. And it's been the core of my life ever since. So I came to it as a way to move through and into, and still into, because it never goes away, grief. And I remember I was going to a lecture, I think it was at Harborfront, And it must have been, I guess, a book event because it was somebody who had written on Elizabeth Bishop. And I have so many Elizabeth Bishop books on my shelf, but I don't know which one it is off the top of my head that was at that particular venue. But the author was there and she was going to speak about one poem in particular. So when we went to our seats, there was a poem sitting there. And I remember turning it over and picking it up and reading it. And it was One Art. We, of course, talked about this poem through her lens of what she wanted to say about it as an author. And I just, even now, I haven't even started reading the poem. And Jessica, I'm getting shivers because I think that's just the power of poetry. And even thinking about a poem before we read it can do that, I think. But it has to be a very special poem to do that. That just doesn't happen to me.
And that was the homework that you had given a couple of weeks ago, was to go and find that poem that gives you goosebumps, which shivers, goosebumps, tomato,
yes,
tomato.
That's right. That's right. And here I am, I guess, doing my own homework, right? But so it's a villanelle, and that's a form where in hearing it, you'll hear how certain lines are repeated, certain sounds. It's a beautiful form. It's very rhythmic and hypnotic. But I think I'll just read the poem now. One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names, and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Goodness, she really covers the whole range of things, and you know it's not going to go well right from the start. She brings you in with that heavy tone because you know that loss is challenging. But the way she's flipped the language, she's setting us up, but she tricks us a little bit because she starts with some of those small things that we lose, like keys that we know we've lost, or the things that we don't know that we've lost, like time. And I got lost in that line a little bit, thinking about how easy it is to lose a day, how easy it is, especially now. Can you imagine Elizabeth Bishop in the age of streaming services and all of the media that we consume these days, and how easy it is for us to give our time away to watch series and movies, and sometimes we're not even enjoying them,
but no,
we're engaged in them, right? Mm-hmm. And then how she moves, and it feels like a spiral using this form of poetry with the sounds. It's like she's drilling deeper and deeper into the heart of what she's talking about, and they are not easy things to lose, and yet what choice do you have other than acceptance?
Well, that's
really what this poem is about.
It is.
The art of acceptance.
It is. It is. And in some ways, too, by saying what you've lost, you're honoring the experience of loss. And yet there's kind of irony, too. And you think about the art of losing isn't hard to master because, well, we know that it is hard to master. It's a challenge.
We can even have
a bad day if we're not finding our keys and thinking, where are they? And so it's a constant challenge of losing things, but the way that also brings us back to the dance of what loss is, what it can teach us, and how we can enact through that to not be dysregulated and to find our way, because loss is inevitable and loss is what life is, and how we are changing each day and we are losing who we were as we go through from minute to minute And I think for me, when I read that poem, when I first read that poem, well, it spoke to me on so many levels, but that sense of what it is to lose and the practicing of loss, then practicing losing farther, losing faster. And then when we get to that, there's the four stanzas in tercet, so three lines. And I know readers, listeners can't see that, but there's a tercet then that starts with, I lost my mother's watch. And that spoke to me because when my father died, he died in a car accident. And one of the memories I have, well, there's the memory of getting the knock on the door from the policeman. But another memory is that same policeman returning with a Ziploc bag with my father's things. And inside that Ziploc bag was the watch that he was wearing. And it was mud caked because he did end up in the ditch after the car flipped over. And he was even, quote, on the front page of the Niagara Falls Review because they love to put accidents out there as we when we're driving. It's part of human nature as well. And I remember thinking, wow, my father made the front page of a paper in a weird sort of way. He would love that because he loved to be known, and he was a storyteller, and he was a joker, and he was a larger than life character. So there's irony right there, but he wasn't able to see that here he is on the front page, and that just the horrible quality of what that is and how real it is, all of those things. But I remember I couldn't look at that. I thought, I cannot look at that. No. So thankfully my loved ones just said they didn't let me see it, and I have never seen it. But there was no avoiding the policeman coming by with the Ziploc bag, and my father's ring and bracelet were in there as well too. And I still have that watch, and it still has the mud on it. And the watch actually inspired me to write one of my first poems, which was titled The Watch, and is about that watch and how watch too can be a verb, the watching over someone, and also, of course, the noun, the ticking watch that we wear, and the way that there's an action to it. But even when you think about a watch ticking, and it was still ticking, so the strange quality of having my father's watch be alive in its mechanical form and his heart not beating, all these things, I think, were happening to me as being an HSP back then, because you're born as an HSP, but not knowing what that was. And then coming across a poem like this, which opened up a whole world of how loss can be put on the page and almost then again move into a place of beauty, grace, and elegance, and also a slap in the face because it's hard, and this poem hits you hard too in its beauty. So the way that a poem can hold so much, and the beautiful musical quality that runs through it. I love how you use the word spiral. As you think about form and how spirals are part of nature, and how a poem is then tapping into nature and the quality of sound and rhythm and imagery. And in that shape of a spiral, much like what the Villanelle does and wrapping around itself and coming out again, is very much what the art of losing is. It's an ongoing thing. So then when we get to that last stanza, when I first read it, I remember there's brackets in this last stanza. So it's even losing you, and then bracket, the joking voice, a gesture I love, bracket. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, bracket, write it, and then an exclamation point, bracket, like disaster. And I remember thinking, what does she mean by write it? It's write is in italics, and then it has an exclamation point after it. And I mean, that's the thing about words, how they can shift and mean different things, just as you were describing sort of the way that reading the poem that you shared, prose poem, allowed you to reconnect to who you were. But when I remember thinking at one point, write it is almost like the self talking to the self, because it's hard to write about loss, but at the same time, you need to do it. And it's almost like a little guidepost to affirmation. And going back to Max Ehrman's poem or prose poem, the directive quality of what we need to do and how we need to be active in these moments of making art, and how often we have to remind ourselves, and as you say, being gentle with ourselves. When we were talking about that last episode too, she needs to tell herself to write it, that it's important to do this. end. By the end, we have the master and disaster side by side, because the villanelle is like this dance where the words don't quite come together. They're separated, and then until that final couplet, and then they come to this close, and it's just so beautifully done and never fails to stun me in a beautiful way. So yeah, this poem did that from the start, and decades later is still doing that to me. And I just love that when something has so much energy for us as readers of poetry, what a gift that is for us, and then can sometimes inspire us to try our own ways through our own stories and experiences into words and what we might do, and not a comparison way, because then we could just think, gosh, I could write a poem as amazing, right? So it's like, no, but I can engage in something from my own life to try and make it into an art. And when I think about that title too, One Art, there is only one art. I mean, that's it too. This such a beautiful title, and that sense of oneness that is the essence of what loss is and grief is, because on the other side of it is love. If we didn't care, we wouldn't feel grief. So it's both are embedded in each, and the dance between is the life.
Wow. Well, I agree completely. It sounds like a call to action at the end of the poem. And I want to thank you for just being so open and really bringing so much feeling into this conversation. I could hear the emotion in your voice when you spoke, and you brought this poem to life. So it wasn't an abstract loss over there. By bringing your story into it, you brought to life what we talked about a couple of weeks ago around what feelings teach us. And you demonstrated how this poem and how poetry can, even when it's a poem like this that is not about you, but you found yourself in it. Elizabeth Bishop was a poet long before you were reading poetry. And that is the gift of poetry. We find ourselves in the poems, we find our feelings in the poems, and then we work through them, and then feelings come out through other poems. And then you beautifully described about the watch. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, thank you, Jessica. And again, it's just interesting to sort of see where these conversations lead us, and also how poems and things that we talk about, whether they're poems or parts of conversation or stories or even some of the quotes that we've shared, are like portals. Going back to, we've talked about portals in past episodes, and they can bring us to other places as well. And through that conversation, that's how we're led there. So it's as you say, an improvisation and an active. It's active in terms of the listening. It's an act of listening, and also then an act of talking as well too. And we're always so grateful that our listeners are a part of this, because we really appreciate the sense of sharing with you as well, listeners, and how your own journey is part of our journey. Even if we can't see you, we know that this is part of the journey of connecting on different ways as humans, as we move through the world as well. So there might be that poem for you that you have since found, since that challenge when we talked about, what was it, the couple episodes ago, Jessica, we were saying about finding that poem that gives you goosebumps, right?
Well, I have another one I would love to share. I couldn't help myself when
given
this task.
Yeah. And
this is one that found me just recently within the last month. I was working on, I think I spoke about it recently, on some collages. So I've been working on collages and making my 2023 planner into an artistic, inspired visual display of beautiful things. My cousin was here, and we were doing this work together, and we had pulled out a bin of old magazines, and she was going through them, and she ripped out a page and passed it across to me, and she says, "This one's for you." I looked at it, and it was a page in a scrapbooking magazine, because once a year or so, I love to buy a scrapbooking magazine because they share really great ideas around how you can visually organize your page. So someone had done a painted version of this where they had done some painting. They had handwritten out this poem. I had never seen it before, even though I had gone through that magazine. It took my cousin finding it, and she passed it to me. And it was a poem by Mary Oliver, which caught my attention right away because I love Mary Oliver. Painting was all yellow in the background, which is a color that lights me up. I really enjoy that sunflower yellow color. There was a hummingbird painted up in the top left-hand corner. And then she had written out this poem called The Hummingbirds by Hand. So I'll read that for you now. In this book, there are many hummingbirds, the blue-throated, the bumblebee, the calliope, the cinnamon, the lucifer, and of course, the ruby-throated. Imagine! Well, that's all you can do, for they're as swift as the wind. And they fly not across the pages, but, like many shy and otherworldly things, between them. I know you'll keep looking now that I've told you. I'm hungry to see them too, but I can't hold them back even for a moment. They're busy, as small things are, with their own lives. So all I can do is let you know they're here somewhere. All I can do is tell you by putting my own hunger on the page.
Thank you for that, Jessica. I don't know this poem. What a gift it is to know that it's connected to hummingbirds and is titled The Hummingbirds and the different types of hummingbirds. I hadn't heard of calliope, the bumblebee, the cinnamon, but of course the ruby-throated. Yes. But it's interesting because in our talk about 1R and the way that write it had the exclamation point, and here there's an exclamation point after imagine. So I love the way too that poems are, even if it's not intentional, there's that sense of connection between these two poems now with that imagine, there's the act, and then going further into the poem. And then also one of the ways a poem moves, of course, is that the architecture of what you described too as the spiral in the last one. And in this particular poem, I love how it's moving through this beautiful enjambment. Enjambment just means that the sentence carries down to the next line. So it pulls you and pulls you. And just as a hummingbird would do that, but also that sense, another, I call them hot spots when it's a spot that I'm really drawn to. And I think about like many shy and otherworldly things between them. Sorry, I should add too. And they fly not across the pages, but like many shy and otherworldly things between them. And I love that sense of between. And it makes me think of some of the things that we've talked about already in the podcast in previous episodes. So many connections here are buzzing in my head, Jessica. Thank you. Oh, I should say humming. Sorry, humming in
humming.
My head.
You're humming. Definitely humming. They're not buzzing. Yes. I love at the end too. It ends with all I can do is tell you by putting my own hunger on the page, which I feel connects back to Elizabeth Bishop and 1Art because she's putting her loss down on the page.
Yes.
And her experience with that. And this poem to me feels like a different poem by Mary Oliver too.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a different voice to it.
There's
a playfulness. It seems to flit. There was an energy in it. And I love, absolutely love the idea of the hummingbirds as being spirited, as being something that you know are there, but you can't see them. And I like to think that we have hummingbirds flying between our words, flying between Coburg and Toronto, where we're recording in our separate homes, flying amongst our listeners. I think that that's just a lovely way to think about how we can all be connected. And I like thinking about the hummingbirds as being an energy source that's a connector.
And I also can't think, going back to energy source and our chat about hummingbird cakes.
Right.
So we've got hunger and we've got hungry and it goes back to the cake.
And I think we just need to eat the cake next.
I think we do.
I will have to figure out a gluten-free version of that. My mom is an incredible baker and I almost want to just send her the recipe and say,
how about
that? Make this for my birthday. My birthday's not till March, but maybe I'll order my cake now.
I think that's it's meant to be.
Or
on
every
level.
Teach myself to bake. That's probably mm-hmm. the grown-up thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that lovely surrender. I mean, we were talking about the therefore in Desiderato, and here it is. So all I can do is let you know they're here somewhere. All I can do is tell you by putting my own hunger on the page. And that way that if she hadn't told us and in these words, then we wouldn't know. So there is the sense of how important it is to write it and to imagine the two acts working together.
I want to know more about this hunger. And so maybe in the future we can look into that. What is our hunger? What is this hunger she speaks of? Mm-hmm. I like that. That's caught my interest. I don't have an answer right now. Might be something to think about for the future.
I think it is. Stay tuned, listeners.
more poems, more conversation next time.
Mm-hmm. See you then.
Catherine Graham is an award-winning writer and creative writing teacher living in Toronto. Jessica Outram is a Métis writer and educator, Coburg's fourth poet laureate, and assistant principal of Indigenous education. The music has been generously provided by Shannon Linton. Connect with us online at thehummingbirdpodcast.com.